Before I begin tonight's message, I wanted to kind of start with an introduction because I think sometimes it's only natural that we have filters when we talk about a subject and we have filters when we read the Bible, whether that's cultural filters, whether that's like Christian background, right? For those who have either visited a church or been a part of a church, you ever just like one day realize that you believe something that's kind of weird and you don't think about it until someone asks you and you're like, oh no, I don't know, isn't that the way it is, right? When Travis mentioned how he visited a Lutheran church that had, that they were told or believed, or someone in the congregation believed that unless they were an ordained Lutheran pastor, you couldn't have, you know, you couldn't serve communion, you know? Like, I got to imagine the shock that that person might experience if they walk into a homeless camp and someone starts serving communion, right? You know, and maybe kind of looking at that and going, oh, wow, like, why do I believe this? Or how does this fit within my paradigm? So I just want to talk about sort of the way I think sometimes, I want to talk about the subject of faith. I really do. And for the last 3 weeks, I've purposely kind of been, you know, 3 weeks ago I preached on the love of God. Last week we talked about just that joy of the Lord and how that really becomes sort of the surge that builds into what we believe and the faith that we have. And I purposely did that because I felt like, again, I think the way we view God is important in the way, like, what we believe he feels about us, because how can we believe for anything unless we understand that and have a proper filter for that? And then even the way we that's just PayPal talking. All right. Even the way we, hopefully, yeah, maybe. I don't know. I didn't check the email. Maybe I got a sale. What else? I could do two things at once. Marketplace ministry. All right. So, anyway, I probably sold something for $5. It's like, what? Chick-fil-A money? Like, we going out, kids? Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe. So, what was I saying? Okay, and then our reaction to the love of God should be an expression of joy that excites us, that makes us believe for the impossible. And then as I started thinking about faith, do you guys remember last year we had the discussion about faith and prayer? I had asked people like in the congregation, maybe vaguely we might remember, had asked people in the congregation like what they thought of faith or, you know, and I remember like there was just a lot of sort of different conflicting, you know, views towards that, naturally, right? You know, based on whether we had a charismatic background and someone might go, you know, faith looks like this, or a conservative background, someone say faith looks like that. And some of those things, I think, it's kind of like a Venn diagram. You're kind of right, you know, you overlap some essential stuffs, and then some things are just like off, like what's going on over here, but they're part of our paradigm. And so as I was talking about faith and thinking about faith, I just kept sitting here going, man, like so often our views and our approach to it isn't, even when we read Hebrews 11, where it talks about all the things that were done in faith, we don't always like really admire and understand like, wow, that took a lot. Like, that was a hell of a situation. Like, that must have felt hopeless and overwhelming. We just kind of go down the list, and this guy did this, and this guy did that, and this guy, and just go through the whole thing. I think the first Bible verse I ever memorized was Hebrews 11:7, where it talks about Noah saving his household. And I remember reading that because, to me, I knew the story of Noah before I was a Christian, and so I could kind of go, yeah, man, like, the whole world's flooding, like, what kind of message, you know, theory, belief is that? Like, how do you even communicate that to people? Like, that must have been an unpopular, you know, opinion at that time. Like, how many people back that up? Who paid for the wood for him to build this boat? Just all those kind of, like, that realization. And so before going into talking about faith and what I think, what just sort of sort of stripping some of those filters. So I want to briefly talk about sort of the idea of kind of stripping some of those worldviews. And there's a quote that I wanted to read to you guys that I had read yesterday to the Breaking Walls group and kind of go a little bit into it. And it's sort of this idea to kind of paint this picture of our worldviews and the filters that kind of get in our way. This is by Derek Severs. It says, "Fish don't know that they're in water. If you tried to explain it, they'd say, water, what's water? They're surrounded by it. That's impossible to see. They can see it. They can't see it until they get out of it, right? Fish are surrounded by water. It's what they live in. It's right in front of them. It's what they feel. It's what they see through. To try and explain to them, you are living in water, you know, might be a difficult concept to understand. I mean, besides the fact that they're fish, like moving on beyond, like, I understand how many people are like, right, they're fish. But seriously, go with me on this journey of illustrating a point. It's limiting. And for a fish that lives in a fishbowl, they're going to start feeling the limitation of the water they're in. And it's not until they hit the edges of that fishbowl do they realize the limitations. And I think sometimes our perspectives are so close to us. There's so much a part of who we are that it's difficult to see it and notice it because it's how we've always viewed things. And that it's not until we're outside of that paradigm and outside, or we're in a different fishbowl, in a different aquarium, and we're suddenly introduced to other fish or other environments, that it's not that truth changes, because I don't think it's that at all. It's that the way we view truth expands. We begin to see an infinite God expressed in multiple ways, and we begin to give him the grace to be who he is. And so to kind of begin to get us into that mode, to begin to start looking at faith through the sort of experimental journey that God started in the beginning, and it's not because he didn't know how it would end, but because he gave people free will to make choices and decisions. To really begin to understand the work he started in Genesis, accomplished on the cross, and on his son's return will culminate, you know, and build into something, really takes a journey of like seeing it not through the lens of just sort of this systematic perspective and directive, but seeing it really as what is considered today as experimental innovation, right? Because like I really do believe like God is like the greatest innovator. This guy had some wild ideas that, again, we look back in history and say, that makes total sense. But when we were living, when that was going on, I can't imagine Noah felt like this makes total sense. Or Abraham felt like this makes total sense. So the theory of creativity by David Gailson. David Gailson is an economist that is a huge fan of art, and he was studying and looking at the way different artists view and build some of their greatest masterpieces. And he found that most people fell into two separate camps. There's conceptual innovators and experimental innovators. And conceptual innovators, and the example I use will be Pablo Picasso. So if you could put up, let's do a night fishing in animals. That's the group of guys that are fishing in the boat, Pablo Picasso. Right, looks like a mess, right? Like just a giant thing my daughter painted. But seriously, conceptual innovators like Pablo Picasso are those who do their best work in their early years. They tend to work quickly, they have specific ideas, they can articulate those ideas very clearly, and they can plan precisely and meticulously and execute exactly what they're trying to accomplish. Right? It may not be that you can't interpret what he's communicating. It's that he understands what he's trying to communicate and can communicate that from his perspective perfectly. Right? Like the difference between someone who has an idea of where they're going and how they plan to accomplish it, even if you don't necessarily get it. Right? So someone who comes up with a new business plan might pitch it to you, and to you it might sound crazy, but the way they've had it planned out and the way they're moving, you know, towards that process is very clear to them. And they can label things. They can, like I said, it's concise. They can communicate specific ideas. So here, while it's difficult to sort of read and understand, you have architecture, like some of the buildings from the city of Guernica in Spain. So you see those like purple mountain-looking things? Those are actually buildings. Then you've got two guys that are fishing, right, in the middle of the night. And then you have two onlookers on the right, two females that are watching these two men fishing. One is on a bicycle, and you sort of see the different fish at the bottom of the lake that they're in. So here, while many would not understand it, you know, today, like obviously, I remember Pablo Picasso is one of those guys that I do not like, right? Like, I love what he's trying to accomplish. I really do. Like, when you read about sort of his anti-war stance, the way he viewed World War I and the expectation of the end of the world, like, and how he added a lot of those elements in his paintings, right? Like, later on, a lot of his paintings took on sort of like a night feel, because in his perspective, the world was supposed to end yesterday. Hurry up, God. You know what I mean? His expectation is everything's coming to an end. And so some of his later pieces had specific patterns where he was communicating that. Pablo Picasso started very early and came early on in the scene in his early 20s, painting stuff that most people were just buying up like crazy. He's considered to be one of those guys that hit the ground running and in his time was doing really, really well. This painting in particular was painted in 1939 when he really had taken his ultimate expression of how he wanted to communicate the way he understood the world around him into this painting. As opposed to a 1903 work that he did 30 years prior. It's The Old Guitarist. Simple. You understand exactly what you're looking at. You know, it doesn't take a genius to understand it's a guy playing a guitar, right? This is where he started. And he goes, all right, very simple ideas that you can understand. And he built up into something that was far more complex. So really, Pablo Picasso is a great example of a conceptual artist that really understood exactly what he was building and moving towards. The next group of painters and writers, and I'm actually gonna later on cite some directors and some writers that were in these individual camps. But for experimental innovators, and this is where I think ultimately that faith journey will most resemble when we get to Hebrews 11 and begin to read that chapter, is really experimental innovators. These are people who never have a clear, easily articulated idea. They don't work quickly, and when they start out, they don't know where they're going. They work through trial and error, and they do endless drafts, often perpetually unsatisfied, taking a lifetime to figure out what they want to say through their work. How many of you guys feel that way? You start something, you know that you're trying to accomplish something, you don't know what it is. You know what it isn't, right? When you try something and it doesn't work out, you're like, no, that's not it, and you move on to the next thing. And some people around you are going, wow, you're disorganized, like, where are you coming from, right? You know, like, and I'm not downing one side or another, but simply that culturally, we understand conceptual innovators, right? In a post-Greco-Roman logic and clarity as being the most celebrated things in our time, if someone can say something very logical and kind of make facts to fit their own paradigm and communicate those things, we call them very smart, wise people. Because it's the ultimate form of like what we believe wisdom and intelligence is, where so much of God's journey can work and operate in that same way. But we do live in a time where we do sort of can't see God as this experimental innovator, where I do believe that faith journey really looks like, where you don't know what's going to happen next, other than you're assured of who he is and where you're going, right? You're just like, I don't know what the next step is. I don't know how we're going to get there. I just know that we have to move in this direction. I know we need to build a boat. That's all I understand, you know? And so I'm going to build this boat. So the next set of painting is Paul Cézanne, considered one of modern Impressionists' greatest painters. This is the card players, or as I like to joke around, these are me and my friends playing Magic. Just kind of hanging out, playing Magic the Gathering around the table. There's always one guy who doesn't want to play. I see the cards. It's coming. You're going to lose. Put the pipe down and focus. Paul Cézanne painted this painting in the late 1800s, somewhere between 1892. Paul Cézanne really struggled with a lot of his work. Here was a guy who was a popular Impressionist looking back and in his later work, but so much of his paintings were later discovered to have slash marks because they were later restored because he'd get so angry he would destroy the canvas. He's like, this isn't what I want. Like, he'd like tear it to pieces and someone later on would piece it back together and it's still set up in museums around the world today. So here you have this French painter who struggled with the way he understands things. Or the approach for most conceptual artists when it comes to actually painting something that becomes sort of their work of art is, or their masterpiece or their final product is to draw it out, sketch it out, work out some of the details, details, decide what kind of paints you want, you know, and then kind of progressively, especially if they're doing a series, right, 4 or 5 portraits that have a very similar theme, you see the progression get better. They have a track, they have a plan. They learn more easily from their previous mistakes, and you see, like, in a set of 4, the 4th one is, like, the best one. Experimental innovators or artists have a much harder time. Their ideas take different shape half the time. They set up the canvas and just jump in, and they don't know. I don't know what I'm building. I just know I want to paint. I know what I'm feeling. I know I want to move in this direction. And so often, it's not until they get to the end product, and in many cases, once they're there, they don't even feel satisfied. Do they finally begin to sort of accept what's in front of them? So Paul Cézanne really struggled, really, like, a lot of times when I read Hebrews 11, he's the person I think of when I think of Moses. How has he not let us go after that last plague? I do not understand what it's going to take. Like, okay, he's going to let us go now? Cool, we're free, we're ready to go. Nope, back in Egypt, great. You know, like that constant struggle. What does this look like? What will it be? I don't know. What if Pharaoh doesn't hear me? Like, what do I do? Throw my stick on the ground, it becomes a snake? What? Like, how is that? Why does that even matter? No one builds their political ideologies on a stick becoming a snake. You're not going to let go of an entire workforce just figuring in that frustration. Later on, you know, Moses throws down his tablets out of anger and frustration. I mean, he literally was a guy that struggled with that. Like, because in his mind, it was going to go very differently. We're going to get out. We're going to go to the promised land. And we're going to take it. And we're going to live really well. So let's just do that. The most he was able to accomplish is get out. Like, step one, we got out. Great, I guess this is it. We did this much. Seriously, like, so I realized, like, so much of our faith journey plays into that struggle, into that journey. Can you put up the next painting? This one's called Pyramid of Skulls. This was later on. This was during his final period. He actually had a lot of dark perspectives, you know, a lot of death, a lot of skulls in Cézanne's later work. So it was considered sort of his morbid period. But again, it's sort of the culmination of a lot of his ideas that he's trying to communicate. When he started to finally feel like, okay, I know what I'm trying to say. Here it is. Whether or not people fully understood it, I think in the end he really started to feel at least comfortable with where he's going. That's it for pictures. What was that? Yeah, he made a black deck in magic. For those who are unfamiliar, it's a magic joke. Yeah, it's fine. Kristen Wallace's famous words. What? Herman Melville was a popular writer who is considered a conceptual innovator. He wrote one of his great masterpieces at 32 years old. 32 years old? Still, I mean, seriously, that's young. That's what I'm saying. Okay. Where most people that were well into their 50s, Mark Twain, who we could compare him to, was well into his late 40s, writing and rewriting Huckleberry Finn. He wrote the ending to Huckleberry Finn so many times because he couldn't decide how he wanted to end it. It took him years to finish that book. Where it took Herman Melville less than a year. Consider that. When you're looking at directors and producers, Orson Welles, who did Citizen Kane, was 24 years old. Conceptual innovator. He knew exactly what he wanted, how he was going to do it, was very precise on his approach, executed that plan, Citizen Kane. As opposed to Alfred Hitchcock, who didn't reach his prime in the thriller genre until he was in his mid-50s. Constantly working and reworking his ideas of what he thought a horror or a thriller film was like. And most of the movies that we remember as his iconic films are in his late 50s, early 60s. So again, we often draw ourselves into this approach with God, like everything's going to be in this faith journey so clear, so precise, so exact, and when it isn't, we are nowhere near our masterpiece, nowhere near the journey that he has called us to. And we celebrate those men. We celebrate them. I can't tell you how often I hear people sort of talk about all these growing current church movements and how awesome they are and all these, like, and I'm sitting there going, like, doesn't always work that way. Like, and quite frankly, some of the greatest things done were not built that way at all, or else they would be unsustainable. And so as we read Hebrews 11, it's with this in mind when we talk about faith. It's not about our ability to conceptualize every single detail, but it's about something else. So if you guys will open up to Hebrews 11. I appreciate you guys willing to hear a bunch of junk about, this is how I think. I just want everyone, I understand some people are like, why? Just get to your point. But honestly, this is how I think. Because I really do believe we can often, I can't tell you how often I talk to someone and I say faith and they hear this. Or I say family and they hear that. And I'm going, all right, let's like deconstruct what we're saying so we're talking about the same subject. And so I think sometimes when we talk about faith, there is faith as in my present faith, as in the things that I adhere to or believe, which really stems from just a relationship with Jesus. Christianity is not just a set of beliefs or morals that we adhere to or a set of convictions that we celebrate and like to stick by. This isn't a club or some kind of gang where we just kind of follow the rules and we grew up. That's not what this is. It's the expression of God's heart that cries, honor and love the people around you and me. And from there, we begin to have certain behavioral patterns that get exhibited and how that love is expressed. So there is that sort of, we understand faith as sort of like this expression of our love for God, but there is that faith journey that begins to take, be connected directly to how we're made, how God has designed us, and how he will express the things he will accomplish. So, Hebrews 11. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. A lot of oxymorons. Faith is being sure of what we hope for. So I am sure of something that I hope for. So it can't be something that I have, because, or else I wouldn't hope for it. I have it. It's something that is to come that I don't physically have. And certain of what we do not see. So it's not something that we can actually fully visualize and fully understand, but we're certain that it's ahead of us. I don't know how we're going to leave Egypt. I don't know when we're going to leave Egypt. I just know we need to get ready and go. Well, then if we're going to go, how much food are we going to need? When are we leaving? I wish I could tell you. I just know that he says he's going to set us free. We're on like the fifth plague. I can't imagine he's going to hold off much longer. Another five plagues later. Okay, we're going. We're going. We're free to go. We're ready, right? But again, we don't, for us, we see that Moses journey. And we think, man, if it was me, I would just say, hey, Moses, man, chill out. We've got five more. Once we hit that fifth, you know, that tenth one, we're out of here. No, that wasn't what it felt like or was like for them at all. Like Cezanne, right, trying to figure out where am I going with this painting, how am I going to end up, what am I trying to communicate, what is my language and my expression. It's not something that we necessarily can plot out and build directly. So when I say, what do you have faith in, and I'm asking this question, what do you have faith in, I'm asking, what do you have confidence for? That is something you hope for and do not have, and it's something you feel overwhelming certainty for but can't accurately picture. So take a second to pause and think of something you have faith for, that you hope for but do not have, that you can't picture but you have a certainty towards it. I'm going to give you guys a couple minutes. If you have it, cool. Like, but I really want you to think about this. You know what I mean? Like, let me know if everybody got some. You good? A little quick. All right, we're moving. We're moving along. Do we have any brave people that are willing to share?
My place in the kingdom.
Your place in the kingdom? Can you elaborate on that?
I know God has something for me. I have no idea what it is. There have been good things in England, but nothing solid yet. So, like, I hear some people say, going to be this, I'm going to be that, I'm going to, you know, it's like, oh, cool, what's your place? I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not there yet.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. So, like, your calling, like, what God, you know, has called you to, designed you for. Yeah, that's a good one, actually. It's really good. Anyone else? Any brave people? No, that's really good. No, these are good. Was that? Were you scratching your head or okay? You went like. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. I want to read Hebrews 11, verse 13 through 16. And maybe some of you guys, as we think about what that thing you hope for and have faith in, maybe you might find yourself relating to these set of verses. It says, all these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. They admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had the opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Have you ever felt in this thing you hope for like you're a stranger in a land that you don't speak the same language when you're talking to someone? You feel odd and weird. It feels like what sustains them and sustains you are two different things, right? You know, like I've read about like the experiences of people who are displaced from their country versus people who are displaced in their country. And they were saying when you're displaced in your country, at least you have your culture, people who speak your language, certain things you're accustomed to. When you're somewhere else, you're often unaware of the cultural biases that are against you because you don't fully understand what those ideologies are. And so you'll create sort of stereotypes because you just know what you know and you don't really know, you know, and you're constantly exploring, like, am I doing this right? When I visited other countries, I'm just like, and you go to dig in for food and you realize no one else is. You're like, oh, okay, yeah, no, yeah, you go first, right? No, I'll shut up. Like, you know, you start to feel like that awkwardness of just like, oh my gosh, like, you know, what do I do here? What do I, you know, you begin to feel, I realize that I love being boisterous and joking around and laughing. That doesn't always sit in other settings, like, at all. And what I think is funny, other people do not, like, at all. And suddenly I'm like, wow, I just came off like the ignorant American. Like, that it's like, I totally dived into politics. Like, I just thought we'd have a good laugh. I didn't think they'd get upset. Like, I don't know what stock you have in our country's politics, but you seem really upset that I made that joke, you know. But it's the realization I feel awkward when I hear people talk or whisper. I'm going, am I doing something? Like, am I, you know, is it the way I walk? Like, you begin to feel like how often when we carry our beliefs and our faith for something, does it feel that way? Right? When I hang out with other pastors and other leaders, sometimes I feel, I would argue 90% of the time, and it's not that I'm uncomfortable in those settings anymore because you just sort of acclimate and get used to it, but you start to feel like, man, what gets me excited and what gets you excited are totally different things. Like, completely. And when I'm talking about something and I'm getting stoked and hyped up, none of you are. Like, I feel really alone in that world. I recently, so I'll share this stupid story. So, real quick. So I'm helping some friends with this event that they're putting on that's all this geek stuff. And so I went to one of their meetings in Orlando, and one of the guys was like, hey, I heard you started playing this game. Let me give you some free stuff so, you know, you can encourage you to continue doing what you're doing. I was like, oh, my gosh, this is awesome. Like, I'm like, are you sure, man? He's like, dude, of course. Like, you know, enjoy it. So I was like, what a great gift. Like, I called my wife. She didn't care. But I was like, whatever. Like, it's a great gift. So I'm like, what a great gift, right? The next day, as if, like, God is just like, I don't even know what it means. I'm hanging out with a group of pastors, and, okay, I won't name the ministry the gift is from. Because I don't want to sound dishonoring, and I feel like if I say it, like I'm being a jerk. Does that make sense? I feel like if I never name it. And so someone gives me a bag from a particular ministry, and in this, like, laptop bag, I can tell there's stuff in it. They're like, oh, there's all sorts of gifts for you. There's, like, a faith journal, and there's like, an official study guide from this particular ministry with his book, his popular book right now. And in there, you'll also find some free thumb drives you can have, and some flyers for the conference, and some, you know, and I'm like, but I don't want this junk. Like, I just want, like, I don't, I'm like, I mean, I can take the journal and, like, the thumb drives and just erase everything that's on there. There's probably marketing material on that thumb drive, isn't there? That's a trick. Like, I'm like, I just repurpose all that stuff. You know what I mean? Because to me, I'm going, but as I'm looking at the person, I'm accepting it with a smile. I'm, like, reading their face, and I'm going, you really like this. Like, to you, this is it. This is the ultimate expression of a gift, but we don't speak the same language or see this particular thing in the same way. So I'm just thinking about how I have to graciously accept this and how badly I want to re-gift it to that person over there that didn't get one, so that way I can feel pretty good about them not getting one and simultaneously get rid of your junk. Like, so I'm like finding opportunities to slowly make my way over and try to, and I'm like, oh, it's just going to wind up in my car for 3 weeks. So, like, I'm just so upset about this gift. Sorry. So moving on. So, like, it literally, like, there are times where you feel like, man, what God has given me to birth, I'm already struggling to understand. Like, what is it? I thought it was this. I know a guy who spent so much of his ministry as a pastor, only to discover at the end of it all that he was called to something else. And I'm like, whoa. And when I heard their story of their struggle, I'm like, yeah, I could see that. You were put in a role that you weren't good at by people who couldn't understand what you did. They just saw ministry, so they figured this. They gave it to you, and every time you messed up, they got mad. So you changed your behavior to fit that and were never happy. And it's not until the end of your life that you even discover that that's not at all what you want. By then, there's a wake of tragedy, like personal tragedy, public tragedy. That's hard. Like, oh my gosh, that's what happens, right? You feel like a stranger in a strange land because God births you as not someone who's going to have all the pieces, but because he wants to change things, he goes, it's going to look weird and it's going to feel different and you're going to get made fun of, but you got to move into that journey. Am I making sense? Does that whole beginning begin to take shape a little bit? Not at all? Okay. There's some people who are just like, nope, you could have just done without it. Like, I do not like Alfred Hitchcock. What? So we'll read a couple of excerpts from Hebrews 11. And again, just from this concept, this idea, Hebrews 11:17, by faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son. So he was about to sacrifice the promise. Even though God had said to him, it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned, Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. Abraham gets initiated into this journey with God, and as far as we can tell, had no background with Yahweh. He just gets called out. He spends this massive journey on finally having the promised son, right? He finally has him. He made mistakes. He now has to deal with all the tension in his family. He finally has a son, and he's being asked to sacrifice the son. And he's sitting there going, I didn't even know you did human sacrifices. What? Like, you know, and then he's like, okay, I guess if you want me to, but it's what you promised. And I take it you can raise people back from the dead because you promised. So it's got to come through this kid. Like, could you imagine that awkward journey, that difficult task, that difficult? I mean, again, as if you heard the story, Isaac didn't understand what was going on. So that experience for Abraham to not be able to fully understand what's in front of him, but again, choosing to reason, God has to be doing something. Like, I feel like I'm crazy right now, but God has to be doing something. Verse 20, by faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regards to their future. How many of you guys remember the story of Isaac, who was pretty much blind at the end of his life? Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future. A man who cannot see is making decisions about a future he cannot see. You know what I mean? And he's looking at his options between the son who was willing to sell out all the rights and all the future that they had and the thieving son. This is awesome. I've got some great choices right now. I've got the one who is willing to give up everything he has for hardly anything, and I've got the son who's willing to steal everything, you know, out of anyone he encounters, and one of these has to, but he's just like, no. If I bless the generation, God will do something with them. God promised. God, I mean, a man who physically couldn't see, and probably in the set of verses, one of my favorite examples, and really because it's just so bizarre that I love it, by faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. Of all these things, it's like you get something. This guy's like, you guys are going to go to Egypt and one day you will leave. Unbury me, put me in a box and plant me somewhere else because I do not want to stay here, even if it just means my bones. Like, this guy literally is seeing what few will ever see. Right? Most of these guys grew comfortable in Egypt, figured like, this is it, we might as well settle. This guy saw 400 years into the future for something that could not be conceptualized in his time. And even in the time of the Exodus, most people didn't believe. I mean, really, the work that God had to do to get Moses out of that situation, to get Aaron and all the other Israelites to buy into this guy, and then to work Pharaoh for their release. That's experimental innovation. How is this going to happen? These people have free will and free choice. We're going to have to work this out with them. But ultimately, I love Joseph's example. He's like, I am not from this place and do not want to remain here. Swear to me that you will unbury me and take me with you so I can be buried in the promised land. That's my home. That's really bizarre. Okay. It doesn't matter. You don't need to understand. I just need to understand. And you just need to do. When we think about that thing, that expression, when we feel discouraged about, like, what will this be, right? What is this legacy thing? Like, how do I add to it, not ruin it? How do I, in each step, learning from that difficulty, this isn't what I'm called to do. I'm not sure if this is it, or I haven't yet found my voice, and I continue to have conflict with this thing that I believe is going to have restoration. Like, and we go through that journey. It is a God molding us like clay and asking us to not only be palatable to the situation, not only to be willing to go through it, but also to be easily molded in his hands. And it's okay to pick up and put down. It's okay to wonder and think and try different options, because it's not until we've gone through that. It's really that faith journey. You're not supposed to know what it looks like. If you do, you're doing it wrong. You really are. Like, it's not like that's that, it wouldn't require faith. You know what I mean? It's just like, and yet we settle so often as Christians for things we can understand. And we settle so often and we call it a small things on rough draft ideas that we don't fully get. And we're just like, I don't know, it's stupid, I don't want to talk about it. And it's like, no, that's the thing you were given. That's what you should be talking about. That's what you should bear proudly and go, I don't really fully get it, I just know where I'm moving. We don't. I think like we falter on, you know, sensational events where we're jumping, screaming, and I think that's cool and that's awesome. And then we talk about like, you know, things that we could just sort of, you know, write down and are concise, and we call that faith. And it's like neither. It's this middle journey. And we often lose our appetite or never gain an appetite for the impossible. I just wanted to read you a quick quote by Bill Johnson. It says, it is unnatural for a Christian to not have an appetite for the impossible. It is unnatural because what's natural to us is the impossible. Do we believe for the impossible? Like really, are our ideas impossible, feeling impossible? Do we actually experience what it's like to feel like strangers? Because that's when we're carrying it well. If we feel at home, we're not doing it right. There should be a level of friction and not something that's avoided, but something that we're willing to walk into. So, I don't know. I just want to encourage you guys because I think we should have courage for something bigger than what we understand. Because you either fall under two other camps. Either you don't know that there's anything, ignorance, or you do and you're running from it, cowardice. Right? Like you either choose like either I am unaware and therefore I don't pursue something. I just don't know that there's something out there for me and so I'm not pursuing anything out of ignorance, or I do know and I'm running away from it. But the argument in Hebrews 11, as I read before and after, it's it should look something like this. And the entire list, every single one of them, the number one core thing that it has in common is something impossible happened to that person. Every time. Like, that is the number one leading argument in the whole thing. And at the end, he's just, like, broad brushing it. There are people who died and came back. There were people who won victories that they shouldn't have. There were, I mean, all of these people did not want to be perfected aside from you. So, you know what I need you to do? Stop doing sin and start moving towards the impossible. Because you do sin because you ain't going after this. And there's nothing else to do. So you just kind of lean on your own understanding, lean on your own strength, and your life looks powerless. And so eventually you wander off to something else. But when we're willing to be courageous and just say, man, it sounds crazy, it sounds nuts, this is what I'm going towards. So now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain for what we do not see. Be sure of something you hope for. Be certain for something you do not see. Be sure for what we hope for. Be certain of what you do not see. Let that burrow into your mind. And let that be, put that at the forefront. The last thing that I will just kind of quickly comment on, Chris and I were talking about this. Something interesting I found out about an artist and a song that they wrote. Leonard Cohen wrote that song Hallelujah that like is pretty popular today, right? And so I heard this great story, I think it was like Friday or something like that, that he had written the song, and one of the first people to see it was Bob Dylan. And Bob Dylan was like, wow, that's pretty good, man. And he asked him, oh, how long did it take you to write it? And he was like, oh, like 2 hours, man. It took a while. And then he asked Bob Dylan, how long did it take you to write I and I? And he's like, oh, man, 15 minutes. Like, I just loved it, ran it with it. And, you know, and he's like, oh, well, Leonard Cohen lied. It took him significantly longer than 2 hours. And as a matter of fact, after he recorded it several times and wrote it and just never felt right by the song, he just didn't feel right about it. People started borrowing the song and making covers. Anytime someone wanted to do a cover, he had to fax them or mail them 15 pages of lyrics because he couldn't even decide what the lyrics are going to be. And he's like, this is what I have. You do with it what you will. And so people started taking certain elements of the song and just doing it. That's why there are older versions of it that you can listen to that have different lyrics in it. And so it wasn't until Jeff Buckley, who heard it from someone else's cover, who had covered someone else doing it, that he finally pick the arrangement that most people know today. And most people attribute that song to him because it was he that completed and made the song sound right. And later was celebrated by many who were like, yeah, yeah, like that's it. Like you did it. Like you finally, and I found it so bizarre that someone could write something and they didn't understand it, right? And it took all these artists taking a stab at it and no one got it. And some random dude picks it up, pieces it together and goes, this is it. And plays it a certain way and it's like, yeah, yeah, good job. And everyone now does a cover with his set of lyrics because the final arrangement of it. And so to me, I'm like, man, what a beautiful picture of this faith journey that we go through where we just don't know and we continue to massage this thing and ultimately it comes out in this expression. To me, City of Refuge has been the perfect experiment in that direction. We had no idea what we were doing in the beginning. We thought we did. We had projections of growth. We had ideas. I mean, the whole point was to eventually have a coffee shop and do church in the coffee shop. We could. I'm just saying, I just remember that's what we thought it was going to be. I remember the conversations and the names and the, you know, that we came up with. And like, and this is, I was convinced that by the time I was 25 years old, we would have this thing growing. We would have our own building. It would be a nightclub. We'd have our coffee shop. I mean, we just had all these ideas. I remember talking about that in our leadership meeting. I remember Dawn and I would drive around and we would talk about that for hours. This is what it's going to be. And we would paint this massive picture. And like, sure, there were elements of that that were like, yeah, that's it. But there was so much of it that was just kind of us and what we thought. But that's what I'm so proud of, as awkward as that sounds, is that it's this amazing group of people that I love that piss me off sometimes, but I love, like, that I love because it's all these canvases, right, that people have just gotten angry at and destroyed and had to piece back together and had to, and we continue to kind of come back together and try to figure it out. And there's genuine change in people in this community, which is what I love. It's a moving forward towards something, even if it's still not there yet. And whatever this will look like, I promise you we'll know. Like, and even if it gets handed off to like our kids and they have to like rework it and go, we see what our parents were trying to do, but that's a mess. You know, ultimately I know it will be perfected. And when it's finally looked at, it will be like, yes. And people will look back on the journey and go, wow, that was something. Like, where they got these ideas, where they just sounds crazy. But they're here, and it looks great. And they saw something that was way ahead of them, you know. And hopefully on my deathbed, I will say, unbury my bones, just to be morbid. Like, and hang it up somewhere. Put it in wherever the building is. That's what I want, you know. So if you guys will stand up, I'd love to pray for you. Everyone's like, what? Like, yeah. If Joseph got to do it, that's what I want. Set me up, set my body up, prop me up like a security guard somewhere, and just leave me in there. So, Heavenly Father, we celebrate you as a God of the impossible. We just thank you, Lord, for just the love that you have poured out on us and you continue to put on display. Lord God, we ask that you would continue to open up those wellsprings of joy to just release forth the strength for us to carry forward into the unknown, Lord. Whether it's a desert place, a forest, or whatever the climate that we experience, that you, Holy Spirit, would continue to remind us that we are strangers in this land and this is not our city, that you have a better city that you are perfecting. May you continue to protect our language and our culture of just what that heavenly language and culture that you've given us, that you would continue to add to not just our numbers in terms of just people, but our numbers in terms of our hearts, in terms of our giftings, our callings, our ideas, our hopes, our aspirations, Lord, and that you, Holy Spirit, would just cultivate those things into a mighty harvest that your Son may reap and be glorified. May the world be changed by your work in our lives. Amen.